Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Gail Harris. Coming up, the political wedding of the year. Gore endorses Dean. Should the other suitors for the Democratic presidential nomination just give up?
And are U.S. intelligence agencies still not sharing with each other nearly enough information?
Also, the story of a mother who missed her two kids serving in the military so much, she flew to Iraq.
And a 19th century pioneer of gynecological surgery who operated on slaves.
I think you have to look at what the alternative was for the slaves, which was an unendurable life of misery. They were social outcasts even among the slave community.
These stories and the poetry of holiday madness coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former Vice President Al Gore endorsed Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean today in Harlem. From member station WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
The Dean campaign has been trying to give itself an air of inevitability, and today's endorsement, they say, is a huge boost. After a breakfast with local Harlem leaders, Dean introduced Gore as the last elected president of the United States. That feeling, Dean supporters say, is particularly acute among African Americans. Gore said he'd chosen Dean because he was the candidate exciting the grassroots of the Democratic Party.
We need to remake the Democratic Party. We need to remake America. We need to take it back on behalf of the people of this country.
Gore urged other Democrats not to attack Dean. Invoking the civil rights movement, he said, "We're in Harlem. Keep your eye on the prize." For NPR News, I'm Andrea Bernstein in New York.
Today is Election Day in San Francisco. Voters will select a replacement for outgoing Mayor Willie Brown. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The contest for mayor features two ambitious 30-something city supervisors running very different campaigns. The front runner, Gavin Newsom, is a Democrat and handpicked successor to Willie Brown. Newsom enjoys the support of downtown business interests and much of organized labor. His opponent, Matt Gonzalez, president of the Board of Supervisors, is a leader of the Green Party. Gonzalez is running a grassroots campaign backed by tenants, neighborhood groups, and young social activists. The Democratic Party is so concerned about the prospect of losing to the Green that it has sent out both Bill Clinton and Al Gore here to San Francisco to stump for Newsom. The two candidates disagree on nearly every local issue, from homelessness, taxation, and city control of the electrical power system. Newsom has outspent Gonzalez by about 10 to 1, but polls indicate the race is close. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
President Bush has received Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao at the White House. As he did so, the White House warned China's rival Taiwan against taking Seoul steps toward independence. China's long claimed Taiwan as its province. The Bush administration backs a one-China policy and supports talks to reach a peaceful settlement. The U.S. military says two crewmen suffered minor injuries today when a U.S. helicopter came down near Fallujah. The military says the chopper was brought down by a rocket-propelled grenade. There have been two similar attacks on helicopters in Iraq in the past several weeks. On November 2nd, 16 soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division were killed when their helicopter was shot down. On November 17th, two Black Hawk helicopters collided near Mosul after they were attacked by ground fire. 17 soldiers died. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 13 points at 99.78. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the mayor of Boston is proposing a plan that could make Boston the second U.S. city to purchase prescription drugs from Canada for city workers and retirees. From member station WBUR in Boston, Alex Ashlock reports.
Boston Mayor Thomas Menino is presenting his plan to buy prescription drugs from Canada during a city council hearing today. According to a memo obtained in advance by the Boston Globe, the city estimates a savings of $1 million off the city's $61 million yearly bill for prescription drugs. If Boston takes this step, it would join another Massachusetts city, Springfield, as the only two cities in the U.S. buying their prescription drugs from Canada. Officials in Springfield say they have already cut that city's $18 million yearly prescription drug bill by $750,000. Importing prescription drugs is illegal, but so far the federal government has not taken any action against Springfield. For NPR News, I'm Alex Ashlock in Boston.
Today is the last regularly scheduled meeting of Federal Reserve policymakers this year. They'll decide on short-term interest rates. Many analysts predict the rates will stay the same. Supermarket company Kroger and a labor union have reached a tentative contract. The potential deal could end a two-month strike in West Virginia, Ohio, and Kentucky. About 3,300 workers will vote on the pact on Thursday. Talks to end a labor dispute between workers in Southern California and the Kroger-owned Ralph's company are not doing as well. Southern California workers have been off the job since October 11th. Workers are also striking or have been locked out from two other store chains there. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop features a variety of music and documentary CDs selected especially for public radio listeners at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris in for Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Front-running presidential candidate Howard Dean has some new fuel in his campaign tank today with the endorsement of former vice president and presidential candidate Al Gore, who won the popular vote in 2000 but lost the election. Here's Gore speaking in Harlem this morning.
Howard Dean really is the only candidate who has been able to inspire at the grassroots level all over this country the kind of passion and enthusiasm for democracy and change and transformation of America that we need in this country.
Gore's endorsement comes just 5 weeks before the Iowa caucuses and 6 weeks before the New Hampshire primary. Candidate Dean said it was an honor to receive Gore's support.
This campaign is not about Howard Dean going to the White House. This campaign is about us going to the White House, all of us. And I look forward to the day on January 20th, 2005, when we do what Andrew Jackson, another great Tennessean, did. We will open the doors of the White House and let the American people back in. Thanks very much.
Gore and Dean head to Cedar Rapids, Iowa later today. And joining us from Iowa is David Yepsen, political editor at the Des Moines Register. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you.
You know, David, it has to make you wonder whether this is a case of politics making strange bedfellows, or do Gore and Dean actually have more in common than not?
I think they have one thing in common, and that is a visceral dislike for George W. Bush, and they want to beat him. And that explains just about everything that this endorsement is about, in my estimation. Gore believes it's time to move this train down the road. Howard Dean has done well. And I simply think they're interested in beating Bush.
Although there is an internet connection as well.
Sure. There are a lot of similarities, and they've had on some issues sort of new tech Democrats. But it's just the feeling that Democrats have that Bush has not cut it as president, and he has angered many Democrats, and particularly Al Gore, I think, obviously feels this deeply. In a sense, it's very surprising, but in a sense, if you think about it, it isn't. Gore wants to get even here.
Hmm. Well, the advantages for Dean seem pretty obvious. Gore's basically telling centrist Democrats they don't have to be afraid of him. So we know the rewards, but are there risks involved for Dean?
I don't see many. Endorsements are always a mixed bag. Most of the time, they don't mean a whole lot, particularly in presidential elections. People tend to make up their own minds. The endorsement of labor unions or interest groups will mean something because they can deliver votes. But I think in this case, it helps Howard Dean on a couple points. One is the campaign may be approaching a tipping point here where it starts to break for Howard Dean. You've started to see it happen in the polls, and this could be another shove or nudge in that direction. I think the second thing it does is that it reinforces Dean's credentials on the experience issue. One of the things that that Gore mentioned today in his speech was that, you know, these other Democrats who complain about Dean's experience voted for the war in Iraq. And here's a guy, Howard Dean, who, sitting up in Vermont, at least had the judgment not to. And that's important, judgment. And I think that is a very persuasive argument with a lot of Democrats who are sitting on the fence here in Iowa right now, trying to make up their minds, looking at the candidates. And I think that'll help a lot of them feel more comfortable with Howard Dean.
Well, what about that? You're there, obviously, with a front-row seat in Iowa. It's a pretty tight race right now with Dick Gephardt, but Gore has historically been popular in Iowa. So is this endorsement what he needs to really put him over?
It's one of several things, and I think as we look back on the campaign, if Dean wins this state, which is certainly very possible, I think it'll be one of the things that we'll say helped put him over the top. Al Gore beat Bill Bradley here in Iowa in the caucuses 4 years ago by about 2-1. He carried the state. He's been here a lot over the years. Democrats in the state have a lot of affection for him. He has credibility with the activist Democrats, and so his good housekeeping seal of approval on Howard Dean, I think, is going to carry some weight with particularly those Democrats who are undecided or who are just maybe starting to lean toward Howard Dean. I think this will be helpful.
And David, you've been covering politics for a long time. What do you make of the fact that Gore thought that Joe Lieberman was strong enough to be his vice president, but apparently didn't even give him the courtesy of a phone call to let him know this was coming?
It is surprising, probably not the best, it wasn't handled in the best manner. But look, politics is always a game about winning. That is the bottom line. And it is particularly true in the Democratic Party today, going up against George Bush. And some of these other niceties of politics, some of these other loyalties, are just having to go by the boards.
David, let me ask you about how this translates sort of behind the scenes. We see a lot of the Clinton people who are gravitating toward General Clark. We see a lot of the Gore people now gravitating toward Dean. Does that really play out in any way that matters to voters, or is this one of those things that those of us who like to read the tea leaves are getting, you know, very fascinated by?
Well, I think the insider game is not that important to voters, but it is important to the outcome. I mean, Al Gore, Bill Clinton, national figures, they do influence where different staffers, aides, experts go and what they do in a campaign. And I think that this endorsement should help Howard Dean attract just that much more talent to his banner.
And do you see any appetite for a Dean-Clark ticket or a Clark-Dean ticket?
I have always thought that a Dean Clark ticket was a real option. And if you watch the dynamic between the two men in debates, you can tell that there is some chemistry there. It's a well-balanced ticket geographically, and General Clark's addition to the ticket, I think, would definitely shore up Dean's foreign policy credentials. It's certainly something we should all keep an eye on.
Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.
David Yepsen is the political editor at the Des Moines Register in Iowa.
A whole new strategy to prevent another 9/11, a new approach to spying on potential terrorists in the United States, has been offered up by a group of former CIA spies and veterans of the FBI and Pentagon. The idea boils down to creating a new FBI intelligence service composed of agents who would never do anything but counterterrorism. They do none of the FBI's traditional Elliot Ness-style work on criminal cases like kidnappings, bank robberies, and fighting the mafia. The idea was presented yesterday to the Independent Commission on 9/11. But is it really worth anything more than just a lot of bureaucratic reshuffling? We're joined now on the line by John Arquilla, professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Welcome, John.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Good to be with you, John. And what do you think of the idea?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's another case of people who've lived in bureaucratic hierarchies wanting to make yet another. We don't need another new agency. We need to figure out how to make the ones we have work better. The good news in all of this discussion is people realizing that our failure in 911 was of organization, not of intelligence. We knew a great deal, but didn't know how to connect those dots because no one spoke to each other. The basic story is that in intelligence agencies, power is measured in terms of the information you control. We need to create our own networks to fight terror networks, and they have to measure their power in terms of the information that is shared.
There's been so much discussion, John, about why 9/11 happened. We did have a lot of intelligence, but it happened anyway. Are you suggesting that coordination between agencies isn't much better than it was back then?
Oh, I think in some respects cooperation is worse. There are areas of improvement, but it's quite clear that, you know, we recognize the organizational failure and are trying to grapple with it. The whole idea of a Department of Homeland Security is the business of creating a new hierarchy where information can go to die. On the other hand, a great deal of classified information is being shared with local law enforcement now, and things are getting better. And I think this latest idea has a terrible flaw in building a wall between intelligence and law enforcement. Many terrorists make their money through criminal activity, and a great deal of knowledge is gained by these cross connections between the two. Remember a year or two back when IRA terrorist operatives were caught with Colombian FARC narco traffickers, training them in explosives and, of course, getting drugs and money in return. So we don't want to reduce these connections. We don't want to build walls between intelligence and law enforcement. In fact, we want to learn how to walk through those walls.
John, you're the guy in charge. You've just been knighted to run these agencies. What exactly would you do to prevent another 9/11?
I think the first thing I would do is to declare a moratorium on the creation of any new organizations or cells, and I would try to get through the idea that our success is going to depend entirely on our ability to manage information skillfully. And that means it has to be shared. It can't be hoarded. It means also that we need to realize most of the intelligence we need is openly available. I think even these former intelligence officials calling for reform will admit that over 95% of the information we need is openly available. And so intelligence now becomes an exercise in selection rather than collection, and that's a whole new mindset to begin to develop.
You know, John, they're educating soldiers, for example, at West Point in a whole different way for a whole new world. Is there a calcification inevitably in agents who had lived through a very different era, the Cold War and all that followed it before 9/11?
I think you raise a good point, Bill. Our service academies, West Point in particular, taught people about civil and mechanical engineering. That was the basic education for a century. Now they learn more software engineering. And I think the military provides an excellent example of the power of networking, as do many leading American businesses today. So the kinds of things we need to train people to do, yes, that's very important. In the intelligence field, we need to develop more web and net-based intelligence, so what we call clandestine technical collection. But the fundamental challenge is organizational. Unless we realize that it takes a network to fight a network, we're always going to be a step behind our adversaries.
And just to finish up very briefly, John, what's kind of spooky is that we could have had this conversation a year ago, couldn't we have? The same issues are floating around, and what you're saying is they haven't really been addressed.
The spooky thing is that I was having these conversations with the Pentagon and the intelligence community 7 years ago. It's not too late, however. It'll only be too late the day after a terrorist nuclear weapon is exploded. So we have time, but it's high time to get moving in the right direction.
John Arquilla is professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. John, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome, Bill.
Ahead, the story of J. Marion Sims, a 19th century doctor praised by some, reviled by others.
And later in the show, a mother goes to see her kids on duty in Iraq.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
An article in the New York Times Science section recently caught our attention. Who was J. Marion Sims? And why was this 19th century South Carolina doctor being called both the father of gynecology and Dr. Butcher, a man who achieved greatness by experimenting on slaves? Well, to get some answers, Robin Young talked to Deborah McGregor, associate professor of history at the University of Illinois at Springfield, and to Lewis Wall, a surgeon and founder of the Worldwide Fund for Mothers Injured in Childbirth.
The name of your group gives us a hint as to the problem we're talking about. As I understand it, Dr. Sims pioneered a surgical treatment for women who suffered from a childbirth complication called vesicovaginal fistula. Dr. Wall, remind us what that is.
Vesicovaginal fistula is a catastrophic complication of childbirth that occurs when a woman is in prolonged labor for 3, 4, 5 days or longer. She develops a fistula, which is a hole between the bladder and the vagina, which results in continuous urinary leakage.
It's quite a stigma attached to it.
Yes, it's completely isolating socially. And it's the kind of thing that we have forgotten can occur in the Western world because modern obstetrics has virtually eliminated these kind of problems.
Right. But do you work with third world countries, and it very much exists there?
It very much exists, particularly in Africa and South Asia. We estimate there are somewhere between 2 and 3 million women, usually young girls under the age of 20, who have this condition in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the less developed world.
Yeah. Well, Professor McGregor, you've studied the history of Dr. Sims' work, and here he was at the time in the 1800s coming up with a surgery that helped these poor women, let's be very frank, who were reeking of urine 24 hours a day. And
right.
He was acclaimed for that.
Right. Well, he had to create a surgery that worked before he was acclaimed. And it was really the perfection, as he saw it, of that surgery that brought him recognition, and it took him quite a while.
The women that he chose to work on, who were female slaves, appreciated the surgery, even helped That's him right. perform the surgery. But others have said these were surgeries, and often multiple surgeries, that were performed without anesthesia.
Exactly.
It amounted to experimentation.
Right, and it was for several years. It was for 4 years, and he owned some of the slave women. And, of course, women who were slaves didn't have the power over their own bodies. So there's really no way to know exactly how they received the surgery.
Yeah. And where does it sit now? There are people who'd like to revive Dr. Sims' name. He already has a statues in his honor, but there are those who want to fight against that revival of his name.
Right. Well, I mean, I think where I stand is that his story needs to be told in the context. And the context is, why were women having such a difficult time in childbirth, just as today, why are these women in sub-Saharan Africa having so much difficulty in childbirth? In my mind, that was one of the weaknesses, really, of what Sims did, was that he didn't really care to know the etiology of vesicovaginal fistula. His concern was really to find a surgery that worked for that, and then he moved on to doing several other gynecological surgeries without really caring about that context.
It's a problem looking back at the mid-19th century through the lens of our current concerns with race and sex and gender. In fact, I think Sims did care about his patients quite considerably. He was involved in experimentation, but it was experimentation that was directed towards a direct therapeutic benefit for his patients.
Yeah, but some would say, with disregard for the slaves that he was performing that surgery on, they weren't as much his patients as, you know, subjects of his experiments.
Well, they were patients. They were just undergoing experimental surgical procedures. And in the final analysis, they were successful. I think you have to look at what the alternative was for the slaves, which was an unendurable life of misery. They were social outcasts. They were social outcasts even among the slave community. Women in Africa with fistulas today are complete outcasts in the communities in which they live. Sims was the only person who showed any concern or any compassion for them. Surgery in the 19th century was not a pleasant experience for anybody, and yet they did end up with significant benefit from that.
I would argue that it's very important when you talk about Sims and his historical legacy to talk about some of the ethical concerns we have today, simply the idea that we can't talk about him as the father of gynecology without recognizing that he was dependent on slaves to do what he did. You know, he did experiments, for instance, on slave infants on prying open the skull around their soft spot for neonatal tetanus, and he didn't do that on white babies. He only did that on slave infants. So I think that there was a tendency that he had to use the power of the white race in the context of slavery, that in thinking about what medicine is and what its history is, we need to recognize that part of its past. Mm.
Dr. Wall, I'm wondering if your great concern now is not necessarily how Dr. Sims is viewed through, you know, history, but how the women you're attending to can benefit from what he learned.
Absolutely. Sims is dead, and all of the patients he ever took care of and all of their children and grandchildren are all dead. But for millions of women around the world, lack of access to obstetric care causes horrific birth injuries. The other problem is getting those women who have these injuries to centers where appropriate surgical therapy is present, because they may live for decades in this condition.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Certainly my pleasure.
Yeah, I've enjoyed being here. Thank you very much.
Dr. Lewis Wall, surgeon and founder of the Worldwide Fund for Mothers Injured in Childbirth. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And Deborah McGregor, associate professor of history at the University of Illinois at Springfield.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, President Bush has warned Taiwan to stop any moves toward independence. We'll look at that delicate issue as the Chinese premier visits the U.S.
Also tomorrow, another issue controversial in U.S. relations with China. We talk to author Patrick French about his new book, Tibet, Tibet, A Personal History of a Lost Land.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Rhode Island's attorney general meets with families of people who died in the station nightclub fire. Criminal indictments could be coming.
And a woman travels thousands of miles to see her daughter on duty in Iraq.
She looks so skinny. When she saw me, she started crying like me. And she said, "Oh, Mom, I'm so happy to see you again."
And holiday poetry beyond Clement Moore.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Al Gore is backing Howard Dean for president in a speech that condemned the Iraq War. As much as it praised Dean, Gore told Democrats they need to come together to defeat President Bush next year.
In a field of great candidates, one candidate clearly now stands out. And so I'm asking all of you to join in this grassroots movement to elect Howard Dean president of the United States. Thank you.
Joe Lieberman was Gore's running mate in the 2000 presidential election. Lieberman says he was surprised by Gore's endorsement.
I was caught completely off guard. No notice. I heard about it from the media. I was surprised, therefore. But, you know, I'm more determined than ever to continue to fight for what I believe is right.
Presidential candidate Joe Lieberman speaking on NBC's Today Show. More U.S. casualties as insurgents continue their attacks in Iraq. Suicide bombers attacked two U.S. military bases in Iraq today. Nearly 60 U.S. soldiers were hurt in one bombing, while two were hurt in the other. Meantime, the U.S. military says an Army helicopter made an emergency landing, but it is not confirming witness reports that a rocket-fired grenade hit the aircraft. President Bush had a stern warning for Taiwan today, urging it to stop making moves toward independence from China. The message came during an Oval Office meeting with China's premier. After the meeting, President Bush told reporters that the U.S. opposes any action from Beijing or Taipei to change the status quo. The Taiwanese are planning a referendum in March that is widely seen as a stepping stone toward a full break from China. China considers Taiwan a renegade province and has vowed to reclaim it. A grand jury in Rhode Island has wrapped up a 9-month investigation into last winter's deadly nightclub fire. Mark Deegan reports from the courthouse.
Judge Nettie Vogel confirms that the grand jury investigating the Station nightclub fire did meet today and did issue a report. That report is sealed, though. Whether anyone has been indicted is unknown. It would be unsealed once anyone charged came to court to respond to criminal charges.
Mark Deegan reporting the fire claimed 100 lives and destroyed the Station nightclub in West Warwick, Rhode Island. It started during a pyrotechnic display put on for the band Great White. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harrison for Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Today, Rhode Island Attorney General Patrick Lynch is meeting with survivors and families of victims of the Station nightclub fire, which killed 100 people in February. The grand jury investigating the case met with the judge this morning, and the judge confirmed that the grand jury did issue a report on the fire. WRNI reporter Martha Biebinger is outside the Attorney General's meeting. And Martha, what can you tell us? Will those indictments come out today?
What we know so far, Gail, is that the attorney for Jeff Dedarian, former HDH and WPRI television reporter, plans to be at the Kent County Courthouse at 2 o'clock. He would not say why, but that information does confirm what we have heard from the Attorney General's office, that if there are indictments, they would follow the meeting that the Attorney General is having with families of the survivors and victims. Jeff Dedarian was a co-owner of the Station Club. He co-owned it with his brother, Michael.
Was there any reaction from the families who were on their way into that meeting?
There is mixed reaction. Some people are here just for information. Some people were making pleas for more individual contributions to the various station club funds that have helped families cope with medical expenses as well as loss of income. One woman was carrying a piece of the polyurethane foam that lined the walls of the station club, and the belief is that that foam fueled the fire in a way that made it nearly impossible for all of the people who were in the club at the time to get out alive.
And Martha, of course, this is a criminal investigation that we're talking about, but there are also civil suits that have been filed by the families. What can you tell us about those?
9 suits have been filed so far. 1 was originally filed in Connecticut. It's been transferred to Rhode Island. There is still 1 suit pending in Massachusetts. The judge at the federal courthouse in Providence is deciding whether a federal law that took effect just about 20 days before the fire started will be the presiding law that under which these cases will be heard, or whether they'll be sent back to state court. So they're still in a procedural stage right now. About 200 other families and survivors have contacted attorneys, so there is expected to be a flood of lawsuits once the question of whether they belong in state or federal court is settled.
And just quickly, Martha, what has changed? You mentioned about the illegal flammable packing foam a moment ago. What's changed, if anything, in terms of the fire code inspections in Rhode Island?
Starting February 20th, the first anniversary of the fire, there will be changes in the building code and fire code structure for buildings in Rhode Island. Starting in 2005, buildings that handle 150 occupants or more will be required to have sprinklers. And in 2006, additional sprinkler requirements take effect.
All right. Thank you very much, Martha.
Thank you, Gail.
Martha Beeminger is a reporter for WRNI.
Here's a new twist on that old question. It's 10 p.m. in Baghdad. Do you know where your children are? Well, Annabella Valencia decided to get an answer to the question. She informed her son and daughter, who are serving in the U.S. military in Iraq, she was going to see them. Now, while on leave in the U.S., her son tried to talk his mother out of it. But Annabelle traveled anyway to one of the most dangerous places in Iraq, to Tikrit, to check up on her daughter, Giselle. Annabelle Valencia is now back home. Annabelle, first, tell me about your son and daughter.
Okay, my son, Chubeni Valencia, is in Baghdad. He's an Airborne 82nd Division, and he's 22 years old. And my daughter, Giselle Valencia, she's in Tikrit. She's 24, and she's a driver.
Then you traveled thousands of miles into a very dangerous place.
Yes.
And as far as your daughter's concerned, there you were at the gate of Task Force Ironside, the 4th Infantry Division in Tikrit, Iraq, trying to see your daughter, Giselle,
yes,
who you hadn't seen in 3 years.
Yes.
What happened?
We came that day, and one of the sergeants said that my daughter was in a mission to Baghdad, and I got so sad because I told them that I will be there that day, so I was so unhappy, so sad, and they said, well, sorry, but she's going to be maybe too late in the night or tomorrow morning, so you can't stay here, and I said, well, but I want to see my daughter, and she said, well, if you want to come back tomorrow, we can make an appointment for you, and maybe you can see your daughter.
Your daughter was driving a truck to Baghdad, and what happened? Did you come back the next day?
Yes, I did. We came the other day. I was dressed with like Iraqi people, like Iraqi women.
Uh-huh.
And when I got there, the sergeant spoke to me, and he was so nice. They drove to a different place inside the compound. And then I was waiting there about half an hour or 50 minutes, I think. And then when my daughter came, oh, it was beautiful. Beautiful.
What was that like?
Well, the first impression that I saw, it was my daughter with a big gun. And I said, oh, my God, she's supposed to be in school and college, and now she's doing this. But I feel so proud of her.
Mm.
It was a beautiful moment. I can explain myself.
Mm. You hadn't seen her in 3 years.
She looked so skinny.
And when she saw me, she started crying like me. And she said, "Oh, Mom, I'm so happy to see you again. And I'm okay. Don't worry. Everything is fine. I know I'm in a dangerous place, but I'm fine. And I hope I will be at home soon."
Annabelle, how much time were you able to spend with Giselle?
2 hours.
2 hours.
Yes.
And then what happened?
And then we took a lot of pictures.
Hmm.
And the sergeant was beautiful with me and a special person. He brought me food. And he said that it was the first time that somebody come to visit a soldier.
Right, right. Annabelle, how do you feel about not only your daughter being over in Iraq, but all these thousands of young people? What do you think about what the United States is doing there now?
Well, I feel so sad. I think that troops must come back to home, and Iraqi people do the rest. They're supposed to take the power, not the United States.
How were you treated by Iraqis over there?
Oh, they're beautiful. They were beautiful with me, friendly. The little kids were kissing me all the time, hugging me, sending me kisses, and beautiful, beautiful. It was a beautiful experience to be there.
I guess you've already had your Christmas.
Yes. Thanks to my God. Yes. It was beautiful.
Annabelle Valencia, thank you very much for joining us about your trip.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Annabelle Valencia has just returned from a trip to Iraq, where two of her children are stationed with U.S. forces. She traveled with Global Exchange, a group opposed to the war in Iraq. She joined us from Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. It's only on the inside pages of newspapers that readers will have noticed a slow tectonic shift in the global economy in the last 2 years. Since the summer of 2001, the U.S. dollar has lost a third of its value against the euro. Or to turn it around, the euro has gained 41% against the dollar. Well, joining us from New York is Stephen Leslie. He is managing editor of The Economist magazine. Welcome, Stephen.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. First of all, help us analyze what this means for Americans.
Well, if you're one of those minority of Americans that travel overseas, it means that you're having to pay a lot more for your lodging, for your transportation, and for your meals overseas. But the bigger impacts are on our economy as a whole, because, of course, we live in a globalized marketplace now, and American firms compete with foreign firms.
And so this could also mean, what, more jobs for Americans?
Well, it could. You know, one very important impact it has is on exporting firms. And the U.S. is a big exporter. We export computer equipment. We export all kinds of earth-moving equipment and those sorts of things. And there's a lot of people who work in those companies.
You also point out in the article that this is actually more important, has more impact than, say, the price of oil or computer chips.
Well, yeah, it is one of the main financial flows in the world. Now, one reason we haven't been paying that much attention to it on the front page of the paper, as you noted, is that it's happened in a rather gradual way, and that's a good thing because that gives everybody time to adjust to it.
And why is this happening? Why is the dollar now less attractive to foreign investors?
Well, the fundamental reason is the U.S. budget deficit, for one thing, requires us to attract in a lot of money. Our current account deficit, which is our imbalance of shipments overseas over our imports, is out of balance also. And thirdly, our interest rates are very low. They're lower than in our partner countries. They're lower in Canada and the UK and in the Eurozone. And these are all things that drive down the value of the dollar.
Now, in the past, we read a great deal about how Europeans were hoping that the euro would strengthen against the dollar and would then become sort of the currency of choice worldwide. Is that now going to happen?
There doesn't seem to be any indications yet that that the dollar is losing its place as the key world currency. In fact, most central banks and many savers, private savers, continue to hold a great deal of their assets in the dollar. Big markets for commodities like oil and almost every other commodity are still conducted in the dollar. Most trade, even between countries that don't use the dollar in the normal course of affairs, is still in the dollar. So we haven't seen any shift towards the euro or any other currency, for that matter, as an international currency.
All right, Stephen. Well, we started with the viewpoint of the American consumer. Maybe we should finish there. So next summer, I'll have more money, better pay perhaps, and can get some deals inside America, but woe is me if I try to go to Europe for the summer.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid Europe has become very expensive. Asia might be a better choice. A lot of the Asian governments are deliberately keeping their currencies weaker against the dollar. Not weakening, but they're not letting it rise as far as the euro has risen. So Asia might be a better choice for next summer.
All right, Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Leslie is managing editor of The Economist magazine.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Once again, this holiday season, you may find yourself agreeing with that great sage, Charlie Brown, when he decried the commercialism, the glitz, of the one day of all days supposed to be free of all that, Christmas.
I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
Still, as most of us know, Charlie Brown's Christmas does have a happy ending. Linus, Lucy, and the entire Peanuts gang do wind up learning the true meaning of Christmas, which is, of course, to give, not to receive. But for many, the jury's still out on whether it really is the poetry or the pickings when it comes to Christmas. So we thought we'd get at the two sides of the debate via Here and Now's resident poets. Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo, they join me in the studio. And hi there, guys.
Hi, glad to be here.
Good to be here, Bill.
Well, Jim, what's your stand? Which side of the debate do you come at Christmas from?
Well, it's hard. I work in a bookstore, but in general, I think it can be overwhelming, the amount of glitz and
the
and,
stuff that's out there.
I mean, I was listening on Thanksgiving to different radio stations. Already they were starting with the right. Holiday tunes, and you're just like, oh, no, you know, what am I going to do for the next month and a half?
Yeah.
But it is hard, and I think it can be overwhelming sometimes. So I did take the anti-commercialism sort of Linus-y kind of side.
But Molly, you think there's something to be said for commercialism, darn it.
I do indeed think there's something to be said for commercialism. The whole idea of it started with giving. The shepherds were giving, the kings were giving. Giving is part of Christmas. And while it doesn't need to take over, it's a part of it that has its place.
And to be a giver, I think I'm quoting an old Woody Allen movie, to be a giver, there must be a receiver, right?
That's right.
Well, you've both written poems that reflect your viewpoints. Jim, let's start with you.
Well, I wrote one. We've decided to write sonnets so that you'll hear the rhymes, and hopefully I wouldn't have messed this up too bad. It's called The Holiday Sonnet. The lights, the lines, the bells, the ads, the crowds, our heads, our goo in the holiday glow. Jingle bells bong and they're jingle bell loud. December commercialism, please, no. Just every 4 years should this be allowed. Gift wrap and glitter collecting like snow. I don't feel excited. I don't feel proud at the shops, stores, and parking lots we go. Where's the quiet corner we might enjoy the special moments this season's about? Like the joyful faces of girls and boys, the greedy fury always freaks me out. Come on, let's take our holidays back from the flashy, soulless retail attack.
A call to arms this Christmas from Jim Burley.
And that was the non-commercial poem, The Call to Arms, I'd like to point out. I like the idea of every 4 years we're allowed, like the Olympics.
Like the Olympics.
Christmas.
I thought that would be kind of nice. You'd be like, oh, yeah, it's Christmas this year.
All right. Molly. Well, here's the commercial side, Holiday at the Mall. So slowly I travel, as though not car, but camel train carries me to the mall. There I buy a past-season Poshmana shawl, half price, and peach body cream in a white jar, in the gourmet shop pears and red caviar. Then for the Giving Tree boy, a football, youth, NFL size. Have I gotten it all, I wonder, picking up shiny red paper? Christmas surrounds us, a glowing spirit so filled with love that gladly we give more wherever we can. Like shepherds and kings, we hear the news of joy and must share it. Gold for the Christ child standing outside the store. Thank you. God bless you. He rings and he rings.
Wow. See, now hers is a Petrarchan sonnet.
Yes.
And mine is more of a sort of a Shakespearean sonnet.
That's
although
true.
Shakespeare probably wouldn't really be into my song.
Well, one thing's for sure. Poets have been writing about Christmas for a long time.
Oh, yes. And a lot of grumpy poems about how annoying Christmas is, but very few and how many people like commercialism. I did find one poem by a poet named James Schuyler. This is called Self-Pity is a Kind of Lying, Too. It's snowing, defective vision days, and Xmas is coming like a plow. And in the meet the snow, strange, it all reminds me of an old lady I once saw shivering naked beside a black polluted stream. You felt terrible, but the train didn't stop, so. And the white, which is some other color or its absence, it spins on itself, and so do the Who at Leeds I'm playing to drown the carols blatting from the Presbyterian church steeple, which is the same as fighting fire with oil. Naked people. Old, cold. One day, we'll just have snow to wear, too.
Who live at Leeds Christmas?
He loves apparently, he likes the Who. Who knew?
Who's the poet again?
This is James Schuyler, who's James a Schuyler. Poet from New York.
Yeah. Molly?
Well, on my side, I have Joseph Brodsky, former poet laureate of the United States in 91 and 92. And he wrote one. This is from a book called Nativity Poems by Joseph Brodsky. This is December 24th, 1971. When it's Christmas, we're all of us magi. At the grocer's all slipping and pushing, where a tin of halva, coffee-flavored, is the cause of a human assault wave by a crowd heavy-laden with parcels, each one his own king, his own camel. Nylon bags, carrier bags, paper cones, caps, and neckties all twisted up sideways, reek of vodka and resin and cod, orange mandarins, cinnamon apples, floods of faces, no sign of a pathway toward Bethlehem, shut off by a blizzard. And the bearers of modern gifts sleep on buses and jam all the doorways, disappear into courtyards they gape, though they know there's nothing inside there, not a beast, not a crib, nor yet her round whose head gleams a nimbus of gold, emptiness. But the mere thought of that brings forth lights as if out of nowhere. Herod reigns, but the stronger he is, the more sure, the more certain the wonder, and the constancy of this relation is the basic mechanics of Christmas. And the poem goes on, but I think what he's trying to say in part is that they offset each other. The commercialism balances out with the other and makes the other shine brighter.
Wow.
And that's Joseph Brodsky, Nativity Poems. It's a whole book of Christmas poems?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it's a terrific book.
Well, Molly and Jim, why don't we just end it there, somewhere in the middle between the poetry and the pickings.
Okay.
And thank you both so much for coming in, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Peace on earth.
Happy holidays. Hang in there.
Keep your spirits up. Here and now's resident poets, Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo.
A giant in Cuban music died in Havana yesterday, the pianist and Buena Vista Social Club member, Ruben Gonzalez. Born in 1919, Ruben Gonzalez originally wanted to be a doctor, but the Havana nightclubs and keyboard lured him away. Music became his healing force. Throughout the 40s and 50s, Gonzalez performed in nightclubs throughout Havana, including the famed Tropicana, leaving his beloved Cuba occasionally to work in clubs in Panama and Argentina. In the late 1980s, Ruben Gonzalez retired, but then musician and record producer Ry Cooder met up with him, and the Buena Vista Social Club was born.
De Alto Cedro voy para Macané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarí.
For the past 6 years, Ruben Gonzalez earned international fame, released 2 solo CDs, toured throughout the world, and always maintained that music was the perfect remedy for the body and soul. Ruben Gonzalez died in Havana at the age of 84.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll look at the delicate issue of Taiwan as the Chinese premier visits the U.S.
And we talk to author Patrick French about his new book, Tibet, Tibet, A Personal History of a Lost Land.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.